Hey there, web or podcast listeners. I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited to make it a little bit shorter and a little bit sweeter. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. You've probably seen warnings at boat launches about washing your boat before going into other bodies of water. Or maybe you've cut your foot on a zebra mussel living on the lake floor, or had to give your dog a bath after it rolled in a dead fish washed up on the shore. These are examples of how aquatic invasive species can be a nuisance to humans. But to other aquatic life, they can be deadly, and some native species are under threat of being wiped out entirely. Invasive species often come into Vermont's waterways via the Great Lakes, and once they're here, they're almost impossible to control or eradicate. There are dozens of aquatic invasive species currently found in Vermont, and many more that have the potential to wreak havoc here and are already established in neighboring states. The best, and in some cases, only lines of defense are prevention and education. We're going to talk about both today, and I'm joined in the studio by Ellen Marsden, professor of wildlife and fisheries biology in the University of Vermont's Rubenstein School of Environment and Natural Resources. Nice to have you back, Professor.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And Sean Good, a fisheries biologist with Vermont's Fish and Wildlife Department. Sean, it's nice to have you with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sean Good, Fish and Wildlife put out a press release about these alewives that were showing up in droves dead on the shore of Lake Champlain. What's the deal with alewives?
Well, the alewife is an invasive species to Vermont. It first showed up in Lake Champlain, we think, around 2003, 2004. We started seeing them in some surveys in that lake. They were previously discovered in Lake St. Catherine in 1997. They're actually a marine fish. They're like a salmon. They live their adult lives in the ocean, but they swim up into freshwater rivers to spawn and lay their eggs. But they are actually capable, also like a salmon, of living their entire life cycle in freshwater environments without having to go out to the ocean. So they're here. They're not really well adapted to freshwater systems, so we see these kind of occasional fish kills, particularly right after a long and severe winter where, you know, numbers of them will wash up dead on the shores.
And is that a problem other than being gross?
Yeah, sure. You know, the fact that these dead alewives are floating around out there is only, you know, a part of the issue. It goes a lot deeper than that, obviously. When this species became pretty prevalent in Lake Champlain, all the fish species that are predators, so trout, salmon, bass, walleye, northern pike, they've become accustomed to feeding on this invasive species because they are so abundant and prolific out there. When they go through these cyclical fish kills or die-off events like that, that changes, you know, the food base and availability to other game fish that are feeding on them. So, you know, that's one, you know, potential implication of these die-offs, other than it being gross and unsightly on the shoreline, is that it's not a consistent food base for our native game fish.
Professor Marsden, how else do you think of alewives in the context of our greater lake ecosystem?
I think of them two ways. They're a competitor with other native species. This is always a problem with an invader. They're planktivores. They eat the small microscopic animals in the lake. And up until now, smelt, which are a native planktivore, have not had that competition. So we look immediately for a negative interaction between those two species. And certainly in some parts of the lake, we've seen a fluctuation. An alewife also particularly have a sort of a Machiavellian strategy that we don't fully understand why, but they produce an enzyme that destroys vitamin B, thiamine. So if alewife are eaten by a predator, any of the ones that Sean just mentioned, then it destroys the thiamine in their bodies. And that usually doesn't hurt the actual fish that eats the alewife, but it affects their ability to provision their eggs with thiamine. So Atlantic salmon and lake trout have suffered reproductive deficiencies because they are not equipping their eggs with the right nutrients.
I mean, you say we're not quite sure why they do that, but isn't it to prevent those predators from reproducing and then prevent more predators from getting the alewives? It seems like a pretty great strategy.
It's a great strategy. And as I say, Machiavelli had nothing on this, but it doesn't benefit the fish that got eaten. It benefits its offspring or its offspring.
Yeah.
It's a two or three generational effect. It could in fact be that, but that's how did that evolve?
And so why not just say, Sean Good, why not put a press release out that says, hey, fisher people, want to go fishing? Get as many alewives as you want. Cook them up. They're small, really tasty. Here's some good recipes. Fry them in butter. Terrific. We'll get rid of them.
Well, that just wouldn't work. they're none of those things that you just mentioned, unfortunately. They are small. They're very bony. They don't have a lot of flesh or musculature to them. So they're not in a freshwater environment the size that could be, consumed. They're just not a tasty fish. They don't grow large enough, and they're not the kind of fish that you could easily catch on a rod and reel. They're not a fish that can be angled for. Ellen mentioned, they're mostly plankton eaters, so it's not the sort of thing that as a fisherman or an angler you could go out and target with a hook and line.
Yeah. All right. So that one's off the table. Listeners, what do you want to know about alewives? But also, we're talking about aquatic invasive species in general, and some of them in particular. The alewives were highlighted recently because they've been so obvious to people, especially living around Lake Champlain, that these fish are a problem, and they're not actually surviving in these temperature fluctuations very well in Lake Champlain because they're not designed to be here. So, Professor Marsden, let's talk about some of the other aquatic invasive species and the problems that they pose. Do we have a sense? I mean, is it relevant to put a number on how many invasive species we have here in our water bodies?
Absolutely. We've got 51. We know it pretty much exactly. As each one comes in, it gets totted up onto the list. The two most recent ones are the spiny water flea came in 3 years ago and the fishhook flea came in last year. And those are what we call macroplankton. They're larger planktonic animals, but they both have a very long spine, about an inch long. And anglers see them because they tend to get caught on monofilament fishing lines. And if there's enough of them in the water, that actually tangles the line where it comes into the rod. So, we can keep track of them quite well because we know what's native and what came in recently.
And the 51 number, are those all considered invasive species? Because there can be a difference between non-native and invasive. I mean, there could be a benign non-native species, theoretically, right?
Absolutely. Just because something isn't native, didn't evolve in this lake, doesn't mean it's going to be annoying, shall we say. A nuisance, we tend to define as being a nuisance in some way to humans. So, for example, the spiny water flea is a nuisance to anglers, but doesn't trouble us too much. But it can also be a nuisance ecologically. Does it impact things that we never see, but we know it changes the ecosystem? One of the ones I'd put in, is it really a nuisance, for example, is brook silverside. It's a very small fish. It has a lifespan of barely 13 months. It's hatched in April, spawns the next April, and dies. Where they're abundant, they're extremely abundant. There'd be sort of thousands of them, and they're on the surface of the water. But as far as we can tell, we haven't seen a dent, shall we say, in the food web of the ecosystem. They're probably eaten by bass. They eat some plankton, and that's about it. So there's a case of probably not a nuisance.
Probably not a big problem, at least yet.
Not yet.
And Sean Good, how do they get here? I mentioned that often they come from the Great Lakes, but how do they even get into their non-native habitats typically to begin with? I know there are different transmission routes for different species, but can you talk about the more common ones?
Sure. So a number of the ones that we have been seeing show up recently, like the two that Ellen mentioned, arrived some period of time previous to arriving in Lake Champlain. They came to the Great Lakes. Zebra mussels is a great example, the spiny water flea. A lot of these invaders are European in origin, and they often cross the oceans in the ballast tanks of ocean-going freighters. So cargo ships coming across from European ports, they're coming into the Great Lakes up the St. Lawrence Seaway, and they're being basically dumped into the freshwater systems of North America from these ballast tanks, which are needed to be filled in Europe to offset the cargo loads that they take on. After they come into the Great Lakes systems, they discharge that ballast water into the Great Lakes freshwater systems, to be able to enter the port. So it used to be that it would take a long time to cross the ocean, and things that were sucked up into these ballast tanks in European freshwater ports would die in the long time it took to transit the ocean. Now these freighters are faster, they're bigger, they're more efficient, and they cross quickly, and things are still alive when they get to North America. So that's where some of these European invaders, you know, how they get across here. Other things are actually taken around and released through the aquarium industry. So things like hydrilla, even Eurasian water milfoil, it's thought that, you know, they were originated just through the ornamental aquarium industry. And people have a tank in their house that they get tired of, they don't want to take care of anymore, and sometimes they dump the contents of that tank into a local pond or a lake. So things like tropical fish have actually shown up fairly regularly in Vermont waters, usually dead when we first find out about them, but oftentimes there are aquarium releases. Some of the more recent ones that I can think of are a pacu was found in Lake Hortonia a few years ago, and that's a relative of the piranha. It comes from the Amazon River and other places in South America, but they're also commonly sold in the aquarium industry for hobbyists. But it either outgrew its tank or the owner got tired of it and it was released. Fortunately, fish like that from a tropical region aren't going to survive for very long in Vermont's climate. But you never know when something that may get released will come along that actually can survive and maybe start reproducing. So that's actually a fairly big source of invasives all over North America is through aquarium releases. And that's something, you know, we really want to try to warn people against doing.
Yeah, Ellen Marston, I'm going to unburden myself at the risk of getting angry hate mail. When I was a child, I had a transparent frog, something like that, and it outgrew its tank, and I was not a good keeper of this frog, and I released it into a local pond. And I think sometimes about that now with horror and shame. I mean, my deep suspicion is that this frog did not survive very long in this other frog pond. But, I mean, it's sort of you're not thinking as a child or maybe, you know, this was the 80s. It was a long time ago, people. It was not, you know, we didn't know back then. But, I mean, that can be a way you think you're just releasing one animal and hoping that it will survive, not thinking about what this could possibly do in the ecosystem.
And that's exactly the problem. And that's why Sean is emphasizing this, is that getting that word out, understanding that this could be a very serious problem. Another species that is on our list of the 51 exotics is goldfish. Now, goldfish are a little bit more capable of surviving in colder water. They're not a truly tropical fish, but they don't. We don't have an established population. They crop up, they disappear. They crop up again, they disappear. They come up in some local pond and, you know, don't make it. So one way of telling one's children about this is it's not just that it might be bad for the ecosystem, but honestly, you know, poor little Harry, your goldfish is not going to make it. That's a slow death. Maybe we should find another home for it. More and more aquarium stores are being encouraged to take fish back, disinfect, you know, because that's always the issue, and then sell it again or breed it or whatever needs to be done. Or we find humane ways of disposing of fish.
But actually, you can often take your fish or your frog or whatever it is back to the store that you bought it and say, can you help me with this?
I'm not sure how many aquarium stores are into this, but it's something I think we want to encourage.
And Sean, do you encourage aquarium stores to do this? Is this something Fish and Wildlife is working on?
Yeah, we've actually spoken with a lot of the pet shops around the state, and it's actually fairly common practice now, and it's recommended even by the shop itself that if somebody's pet fish outgrows their tank or the owner loses interest, to bring it back. Sometimes these super large individuals, you know, actually carry a pretty high price tag, you know, in the resale market. So they get, you know, a fish that's grown to a large size. There's people out there looking for those things. So that's really the best thing to do is to keep it as an aquarium fish, take it back to the shop, and they will, you know, have a way to deal with that. Absolutely. Do not let it go. And you know, like Ellen mentioned, we have goldfish populations. That's the most common one popping up all over the place, including the city of Williston has a pretty nice little goldfish population living in the sewers that we became aware of a few years ago that originated from a stormwater pond at a shopping mall. Somebody released their goldfish in there, maybe just two or three, and now there's thousands of them. And the overflow of that stormwater retention pond goes directly into the, you know, the sewer drain system of the city. And municipal workers have contacted us with photos after they've pulled manhole covers to clean them out on an annual basis. And they look down, and in the sewer drain are swimming around bright gold-colored goldfish, orange-colored goldfish. So it's actually, you know, it's real and it happens, and they do survive, and it threatens our native ecosystem for sure in ways that, you know, sometimes we can't even predict.
The sidebar here, but please, if you are a creative science fiction writer listening to this right now, please write a short story and send it to me about the goldfish living in the sewer system in Williston. Sean Good, can you talk a little bit about sea lamprey? Because this is one invasive species that we're actually trying to work on reducing the population of. Every year you send out press releases, you work on lampreycide, killing the sea lamprey. So what's the strategy with sea lamprey, and why is this such a targeted species?
So, yes, it was said earlier that sea lamprey, or that invasive species in general, are very difficult, if not impossible, to eradicate or control, and spread prevention is the best option. And that's absolutely true. But occasionally we have a situation like with sea lamprey where we can implement some control techniques. And we've been doing that for quite a long time on Lake Champlain in both New York and Vermont, on the tributaries focused where these things spawn. And this is a technology that's been developed decades ago in the 50s in the Great Lakes, where they have the same sort of issues with sea lamprey. They're a predatory fish species that attaches to the sides of other fish, rasps a hole through the side of the fish, and basically drains bodily fluids to the point where the fish dies. So it has a direct impact on the quality of the fishery that we have in Lake Champlain through direct predation of lamprey on lake trout, landlocked Atlantic salmon, walleye, the endangered lake sturgeon. Lots of different species are prone to being attacked and killed by sea lamprey. So this technology that was developed in the 50s, it's a lampreycide. It's a chemical that is put into the water in rivers where the lamprey spawn that directly basically kills the larval sea lamprey that are sedentary at that life stage. They live in these rivers after they hatch for 4 to 5 years as filter feeders. They're not actually predatory at that point. They just filter plankton out of the water. They live in the soft muck and sediment on the bottoms of the stream. And when we can target some of those streams with this chemical, they absorb that chemical into their systems. It shunks down some of their body functions, and it ends up killing them. And we can control their populations over a long term by doing that. We also have other non-chemical techniques that we've been implementing even more recently, where we can just construct temporary barriers to the spawning ground, so we're interrupting their migrations to the necessary spawning ground, so we can decrease their success that way as well. That's kind of a multifaceted program that we run jointly with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the state of New York to basically improve the fishing quality on Lake Champlain for the species that are most susceptible to lamprey attacks, and it's been very successful over the length of time we've been doing it.
So, I mean, there are chemical applications, there are physical barriers that you can use with some species, including sea lamprey. Ellen Marston, I remember, I think it's like 12 years ago now, interviewing a Middlebury College professor who was working on the development of a specific kind of beetle that would help eat Eurasian water milfoil. And I don't think that has been widespread, but there's also that potential, although then we get into adding more non-native species to our waterways, of having other species that can predate the non-native species. Where are we with Eurasian water milfoil?
As you point out, this idea of biocontrol, importing a non-native to battle a non-native is literally fighting fire with fire. However, the U.S. has a long history of doing this. In fact, the world does, because most pests are insect pests or they're disease pests or fungal pests of crops. And those are the ones that really scare us because they're between us and our food supply. So there's a thing called integrated pest management, which basically says don't look for one solution. Don't just look for pesticide. Don't just look for barriers. try all the possible routes, of which biocontrol is one. Biocontrol simply meaning that instead of, say, the chemical that Sean mentioned, you'd use a biological vector or organism. So there's a beetle and there's a weevil that will both eat water milfoil. And they have been used, though I think I'll have to defer to Chet to Sean, if he knows more about how widely they've been effective. The issue, obviously, is twofold. If it loses interest and spreads to other organisms, or for the pest to be effective, there has to be enough water milfoil to sustain its population. If they're very effective and they drop the population, then the beetle dies down, and then you have to get more of them.
Because then the Eurasian water milfoil comes back. And this is a problem because it clogs up waterways, it gets into boats, propellers, and can be really murky and change the quality of the water for any native species that do live there.
Absolutely. They tend to, water chestnut is another one, and both of these plants tend to be at the surface of the water, and what they do is they shade out species below them. So the native species that might be at the bottom of the body of water don't get enough sunlight to photosynthesize, and they are reduced. And the stems are so thick that not only can boaters not go through them easily, it's hard to swim through them, it's just mucky, but it also affects ducks and any other organisms or even fish if the stems are very thick that would have used a different kind of habitat and now are excluded from the new habitat.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're talking today with fisheries biologist Sean Good and with the Fish and Wildlife Department and with wildlife and fisheries biology professor Ellen Marsden of UVM. Martha writes in to ask, are bait fish native? People often dump the extra bait fish. Are these regulated? Sean Good?
Well, that's a really great question. Bait fish is a really generic term that's used for minnows or shiners or things like that. They're used as fishing bait. We have many, many different native species of bait fish in Vermont. The two that are most commonly sold in bait shops are golden shiners and fathead minnows. And those are two species that are native to Vermont. They're naturally here. They are sold by bait shops from a hatchery source that is actually out of state. But the species itself is native. So she's exactly right. Anglers often will dump their unused bait at the end of a day of fishing, and so it's something we're certainly concerned about what might be in that bucket, and that's why we have laws currently that restrict where you can get your bait to go fishing. And right now, anything that's bought in a shop that sells bait statewide has to come from an approved source that we review and make sure that they're selling just what they're supposed to.
Stephanie's calling in from Meriden, New Hampshire. Hi, Stephanie. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well, thanks.
I grew up on Lake Michigan in the 60s and 70s, and we used to have so many alewives. And my question is, now in Lake Champlain you're seeing them, is it because of climate change due to the water temperatures or no?
Stephanie, thanks for the call. Ellen Marsden?
There may be an effect of climate change, but if you're talking about how did they get here and why are they taking off in such numbers, it's likely that the original introduction of alewife to the state and maybe into Lake Champlain was an unauthorized, illegal introduction by perhaps an angler, but somebody who knew that alewife make very good food for salmon and trout. And so if you want a really big brown trout, being in a body of water with alewife really allows them to grow. So it's very hard to control that type of introduction, and that has, of course, nothing to do with global climate change. And then, as Sean illustrated, they take off on their own. The fact that we get these regular die-offs is not a global climate change thing. It's just the life cycle of alewife and their inability to adapt to a cold body of water that temperature fluctuates very rapidly in spring.
Are we seeing any systemic temperature change in Lake Champlain that can be attributed to climate change
that could, I mean, as Stephanie's sort of getting to, allow some species that may not have otherwise survived to get a foothold here in the future.
Certainly. Lake Champlain has one of the probably the best records of temperature and ice cover anywhere. So as a demonstration data set for the fact that things are changing, for over 200 years, people have been recording particularly when the lake closed, i.e. it completely became ice covered, and whether it became closed. And in the early days, in the 1800s, it would close probably 9 years out of 10. Of course, people growing up now know it closes maybe 6 years out of 10 or less. And the date at which it closes has moved steadily later. And that so that also says that the lake must have been warmer in summer. It was retaining that heat and freezing much more slowly.
While we were talking about alewives, Jeremy's calling in from Virgins. Hey, Jeremy.
Hi there.
Go right ahead.
First, I want to say hi to Ellen. I studied with her at UVM, so I was lucky enough to do that, and I know Ellen will have an answer for me. So the lamprey come up the rivers, and we've targeted them on the rivers. And knowing that the alewives come up the rivers, is there any way to target alewives coming up their breeding rivers? I fish local rivers a lot, Otter Creek in particular, and I've caught them accidentally jigging for walleye and such. But is there any way to target the alewives when they're spawning up the rivers like we did the lamprey?
Great question, and good to hear from you, Jeremy. I hope things are good with you. Not all alewives spawn up rivers, unfortunately, so there's a considerable spawning that occurs in the lake proper. So if you could target them in rivers, it wouldn't solve the problem. The way to target them in rivers is the same way we've pretty much extirpated alewife and their kin in their native area, which is to put dams in the rivers. And there's while we're trying to battle alewife and having to put up with them along the coast, people are trying to restore them, and blueback herring, which is also an invader here, it's a prize species elsewhere. The dams cause the problems with those populations in their native area, but we really don't want to go down that route. Any dam is going to have ancillary effects to any other species that's moving through rivers, including our native brook trout and Atlantic salmon and other migratory species.
You know, we've talked a lot about specific species, and while I wouldn't quite call them charismatic megafauna, you know, they're at least you can see them, and they're actual animals or plants. But it's not just non-native plants and animals that are a concern. I mean, in some cases, there are parasitic viruses that can come into our water bodies and really cause damage. And one of the ones that I understand is not here yet, but that we're pretty concerned about is viral hemorrhagic septicemia. And Sean Good, why are we concerned about that?
So VHS, as viral hemorrhagic septicemia is usually referred to in short, is an invasive fish pathogen. It's a virus that, again, originated in Europe. It's mutated a number of times as it's started to spread around globally. And there was one mutation known to exist in the Atlantic Ocean off the kind of the northeast Atlantic coast of North America. But then in sometime around 2005 was discovered in the Great Lakes. And the way it was discovered is that a lot of fish started suddenly dying. And we're not talking 100 or a couple of thousand. It was in the millions. And this fish pathogen, this virus, was implicated as the cause. Slowly from 2005 through 2010, fisheries researchers and managers out there saw that virus jump from the Great Lakes into small inland waters in some of the Great Lakes states, New York, Michigan, places like that. And the only way that they were getting there was probably through the movement of water and live fish. So the bait fish harvest industry, where minnows are being harvested and then sold for use elsewhere, boats being carried overland on trailers and still having some water in the bilge or live wells that might have this virus in it. There's ways that this virus was spread, and it spread very quickly. And every new water that it showed up into had massive fish kills of multiple species. Over 35 different species, I think, have been found to be susceptible to this virus. And it's something we watched really closely here in Vermont because we are connected to the Great Lakes through Lake Champlain at both its inlet and its outlet. And so we're concerned at the time, and we still are, that that may arrive here at some point in the future. And it's a virus that spreads from fish to fish. It's not harmful to humans or other animals, but it can have pretty major implications for fish populations when you're talking tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or even millions of dead fish washing up through a viral outbreak.
That sounds really scary. And Sean mentioned that, you know, in some cases, things like this can be transmitted from one water body to another by boats. And John from Montpelier called in and said, wanted to mention that boat trailers are not often sufficiently cleaned because the trailers themselves have a lot of hollow parts. So even if you're cleaning your boat off, if you're then, you know, driving your trailer into the water to get your boat out onto the water, you could still be, you know, unintentionally moving things from one place to another. So, I mean, Professor Marston, what do we do? I mean, we've gotten the message in many cases, clean your boat. But if that's not sufficient, how can we prevent things like VHS from coming?
This is a really good point, because cleaning your boat for many people just means visually, oh, I took all the weeds off the trailer and I took the zebra mussels off the hull, I'm done, I'm great. But as you say, not only the viruses and potentially fungal pathogens, but even larval zebra mussels can be transported, or their relative, the quagga mussel, which we are afraid will come in any day, can survive for surprising periods of time, days or even weeks, in just moist areas. And most trailers have a carpeting or a soft area on the bumpers where the boat actually rests, so you don't damage the hull. The best solution, of course, is to have everything dried out before you go to the next body of water. That's not always possible. You come out of the Great Lakes, a day later you're in Lake Champlain, you want to go bass fishing. A thorough rinsing with very hot water, with a high-pressure hose, and just push that water off those areas or out of those areas onto land where it will dry would be the best solution. People have talked about, well, I could use chlorine, etc. The trouble is the chlorine itself is very toxic to anything aquatic. So a high-pressure hose, hot water, perhaps a bit of soap, especially if it's biodegradable, will it's probably the best defense we have. Nothing's perfect, but that's hopefully maybe 99% effective.
I don't know. Sometimes I hear this and I feel like throwing up in my hands and saying, well, you know, the apocalypse is coming. All of these things are coming. Great. Zebra mussels are here. They're pretty much established. Can't do anything about them. Quagga mussels, just a matter of time. There's barely any point in doing anything, because even if I clean my boat, somebody else won't, and there we are.
This is the same problem we have trying to convince people, for example, that we should try and close the locks on the Champlain Canal so that species don't come up there. And they're saying, well, it won't be a complete solution. I'm saying, well, but wait a minute, a 95% solution is still pretty good. If we could delay things by 10 years, 20 years, that would buy us time, and maybe we'll find other biological solutions or better technology.
Sean Good, what else do you want to tell people to be more optimistic about in terms of helping to prevent some of these things? I mean, other things, northern snakehead perhaps on its way. How can we be better stewards of our own environment?
Yeah, you know, the things that Ellen has already mentioned are really the major key points that we try to make with our spread prevention outreach and education is, you know, the mantra is always kind of clean, drain, dry. So make sure your boat, canoe, kayak, any kind of vessel that enters and leaves the water is clean on the outside, drained on the inside, and then dried thoroughly. And the recommendation is usually to leave it out in the sun, you know, where it can bake for a couple of days. But again, as Ellen pointed out, that's not always possible. People jump from lake to lake within a day. So toweling it off, drying it out thoroughly with a towel works well, cleaning it with hot water. And then again, just not, you know, moving live organisms or water from lake to lake or across watersheds is really important. You know, we just really don't want people, you know, being part of the cause and making sure that they're aware of the risks that come with invasive species and that they, you know, don't accidentally move something without taking the necessary precautions. Even though we're connected in Lake Champlain to lots of other water bodies that are, you know, invaded, we still need to do the small things, to try to slow it down.
All right. So do the right thing. Try to keep it out of the water. Sean Good is a fisheries biologist with Vermont Fish and Wildlife. Ellen Marsden is a professor of wildlife and fisheries biology at the University of Vermont's Rubenstein School of Environment and Natural Resources. Thanks very much to you both.
A pleasure. Thank you.